Shane Kilkelly.
And I'm Kyle Thompson.
And I'm Callum Kant.
And you're listening to General Intellect Unit. And this this time we are joined by a very special guest. Callum, you get the what I'm trying to make the traditional questions, which I've forgotten to do a couple of times, but the questions for all guests are, who are you? What are you doing here? Why are these things happening?
Okay, so who am I? I am a ex-delivery worker and kind of trade unionist and organiser in the UK. I'm currently doing my PhD at the University of West London in worker organisation, basically looking at service sector workplaces and trying to understand how we rebuild a militant trade union movement. That was who I am. What's the second one?
What are you doing here?
Okay,
we can drop the format. It doesn't matter.
And then I'm talking about my book, Riding for Deliveroo, Resistance in the New Economy, which is kind of a short polemic book about platform capitalism and how class struggle is adapting to a new context and how workers are just being kind of disempowered by the reorganization of capital into these like new forms, but also are finding new ways to struggle. And then the final one is...
Why are these things happening?
What does that one mean?
I'm not sure. It just always felt like good flavor, you know, to just have it in there.
Okay, why are these things happening? Well, I guess I am here to talk about the book, both because I like talking about books and I like this podcast, but also because I think that we need to struggle for a better world, and having the correct revolutionary theory helps us form a kind of revolutionary practice.
I think you're on the right show. Certainly. it's a hell of a book, folks. Go check it out. It's real good. It came out in what, October of the previous year?
Yeah. October in the UK and then November in the US.
Which gives you some sort of indication of how long it takes us to organise a fucking episode.
We had an election in the middle, which really didn't help.
Oh boy, yeah. We can definitely touch on that towards the end. So yeah, I mean, can you tell us a little, like, what was it like to write for Deliveroo?
So I basically ended up in the scenario of writing for Deliveroo because there was, in August 2016, I was working a desperately, desperately boring desk job where I just spent much of my time listening to podcasts. I actually developed a habit of watching cycling racing. I'm not like a cyclist, but cycle races take about 8 hours. If you want from literally the first kilometre to the last. So if you just put one on at the start of the day and have your headphones in, then, you know, you get wrapped up in this gigantic drama. It's amazing. The major ones go on for a month at a time. So you can just literally all day, every day, be watching cycling racing instead of working. I mean, this was how profoundly bored I was. And then in August 2016, this strike broke out in London. And the first thing I saw of it was these videos of huge convoys of workers going around blaring their horns, and they all had these, like, they had the reflective clothing, they had the bags on their back or on the back of their moped. And it turned out that this was a strike by delivery workers. So I'd seen Deliveroo and Uber Eats as services around the place. They were mostly centered in London at the time, but I knew they were kind of in Brighton. And I kind of assumed, along with almost everyone else, I think, that this new form of work, this kind of platform work, was likely to be very peripheral and basically was unorganizable. So, you know, this wasn't going to become a mainstay of the economy. It wasn't going to last very long. It was a fad. And there was zero chance of the workers in these scenarios getting organized because of the way technology was used to intentionally disorganize them. But this seemed to, like, prove the lie, right? Like, immediately it showed that whatever I'd thought about what the situation was, it was profoundly inaccurate, because these workers I'd assumed to be decentralized and disorganized had come together to organize a wildcat strike. And we then went on, you know, I chatted to some friends, I wrote an article about it for Navarra Media, which is kind of a left-wing alternative news outlet in the UK. And we discovered this was a strike over wages. And I chatted to a friend, Petros Elia, who's the general secretary at the time of the United Voices of the World, which is kind of a base union in London, who'd gone along. And I asked him, you know, what's going on? This looks really different. This looks really weird. The trade union movement in the UK is basically, you know, strikes at a historic low. What circumstances have caused this huge outbreak of wildcat strike action? And he kind of basically just said he didn't understand what was going on. He was like, you know, this is remarkable. They're breaking all the rules. They're not doing this the way that I think they should be doing it, but it really, really works. And that to me was, you know, like a red rag to a bull. I was like, oh, well, I mean, what do you mean that you don't understand how it works? But I immediately wanted to try and find out, you know, how are these workers organizing? What are The conditions in platform capitalism that make self-organization possible, viable, and, you know, a tactic being picked up by large numbers of workers. And I thought potentially the best way to do this. So this desk job, alongside being deathly boring, actually didn't pay me very much money. So I was like, well, you know what I can do? I can work in the evenings for Deliveroo. I'll do what, you know, we call a workers' inquiry. It's kind of this particular methodological substrain of Marxism where you use the experience of workers to try and investigate wider questions about the composition of the working class and capital in general. And I thought maybe we could do kind of a militant research project at the same time as earning some money and actually making up for the fact that, you know, I was living in a very expensive city at the time, Brighton, and struggling to, you know, get by. So this project then turned into, over time, we organized a strike in Brighton. We organized a newsletter bulletin thing, which was going around both the UK and internationally trying to coordinate riders. And this initial incident of strike action in 2016 turned out just to be the first in a flurry. I then became involved in this huge wave of strike action, which is really the subject of the book. And that, you know, experience is what is summed up by it.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing you talk about in the book is, I mean, as you said, it was kind of a workers' inquiry project. And you, as a worker for Deliveroo, you did theoretical analysis of your own situation and, you know, related the theory to your lived experience. And so one of the things that was characteristic of your work for Deliveroo was this piece wage system and the self-discipline it imposed. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, so this was a really strange experience for me. In previous jobs, I've done, you know, shitty jobs before, both the office work and also, you know, like minimum wage jobs in a kitchen or whatever. You're getting paid an hourly rate, right? So whatever you're doing, if you can actually survive and just take time off by watching cycling racing or whatever, whatever you earn, you rob the capitalist, right? There's that fantastic in Marx's Capital where he talks basically about loafing about as being a form of like counter theft. So I was used to, whenever I got into a work environment where I was kind of disengaged, which was every experience of work I'd had up to that point, immediately identifying how can I do as little as possible in this job in order to get by. But the problem was with Deliveroo, I was only getting paid £4 per delivery. So if I sat and did nothing, I earned £0 an hour, right? So I had to then immediately try and work out, you know, how can I get as many deliveries as possible? In fact, the whole thing was flipped on its head because I was only being paid for the work I actually did. And because, you know, it's actually, you know, you've got costs for working for Deliveroo. If, you know, only food, right, you'll burn a few thousand calories on a long shift that you need to then buy and eat to kind of, you know, literally yourself. So there are all sorts of costs associated with working the job. And then, you know, on average, you're getting about two deliveries an hour. So you're getting about £8 an hour minus costs. So you want to, you know, get around that and make as much money as possible. So you're really like trying to find opportunities to do work. And for me, that was a remarkable inversion. And then when I went back and looked at Capital, Marx actually talks about this because piece wages aren't a new thing. I mean, he calls them the form of wages most in accordance with the morality of capitalism or whatever it is. I think that's the exact phrase, but he basically says that, you know, if capitalists can get away with paying workers in this way, they will do. And indeed, when I look back at the history, whether it be dockers or whether it be, you know, workers in car factories, there's a long history of using piece wages to force workers to intensify their own work. When you're not guaranteed that hourly wage, you have to do as much as possible.
And wasn't that transition also true for Deliveroo, right? That like in the old timers writing for Deliveroo, they would tell you that like, oh yeah, it used to be an hourly thing and it was hourly plus a per delivery fee, but then it got switched around to just be entirely per delivery, right?
Yeah, so Deliveroo have a number of different employment conditions based on what the kind of the local economy is like. So in areas like Teesside, which is, you know, got very high youth unemployment, high levels of deprivation, they paid £6 an hour plus £1 per delivery because they basically realised that young people were desperate for work, so they'd do whatever. So they could pay as low as £6 an hour. Whereas in London, when they had an hourly rate, it was £8 an hour plus one per delivery. But as you say, over time, as kind of more stable markets developed in cities, they phased out this hourly rate and replaced it with a piece rate. that was actually, that had been the trigger for the strike action I saw in London in August 2016. It's that process of changing the way people are paid. And because you don't have any formal employment contract, that change doesn't have to be a negotiated one, right? There doesn't have to be a collective discussion or even really a pretense of consultation. They can just immediately change the way in which the work is organized. It can change the terms on which you work at a moment's notice. You just have to accept that. You're just meant to put up and shut up.
You just get a little notification, right? Ding. And then it's like, oh, yeah, your pay structure is different now.
Or another one which often prompted conflict was the change from... So there are also... When labour supply isn't massive in a new city, Deliveroo will do a thing where they basically, like, schedule shifts. It's never the case in Brighton, but in lots of other cities across the UK, that was how people worked. You'd get your stats up by doing lots of deliveries and being available to work a lot of the time. And then when you got better stats, you could book better shifts. So, like, if you had really good stats, you could book like 40 hours of shifts a week. You'd be paid on hourly rate plus a rate per delivery for all of those shifts. Now, basically, that would then get changed to a free login zone where people ended up in the situation I was in Brighton, where you only be paid per delivery without consultation again. So all of these, you know, profound changes, including people actually getting fired, you know, they take place without any, you know, due process around them. They are instantaneous because there's not a negotiated contract. You're, according to the legal fiction, you are kind of your own mini company. So it's just the terms of service you have with another company.
So that, like, that brings us to a very important part of the book, right? Like, a big chunk of it is the kind of analysis of the role that technology plays in all this and the particular, like, technical composition of the workforce and how it slots in with all the other ways in which the workforce is composed. So, I mean, can you go on about that a little bit? Like, how does tech figure into all this?
So tech, I think, is really important for understanding how delivery works and its divergences from earlier kind of courier models. Because, I mean, there have been couriers for a very long time. There have been delivery services for a very long time. The idea of people delivering pizza on a moped is not like a new one. The way that has changed with the advent of these apps is not only the customer-facing applications, which make, you know, the selection of a restaurant, rather than ringing up one particular restaurant to get a takeaway, you have kind of a buffet of options. So that's obviously a transition for the consumer. But on the side of the producer, on the side of the workers, the major transition is the automation of the supervisor. So whereas historically, you know, you would have someone sitting in an office telling couriers, go to this place now, pick this up and deliver it to this person in this place. That person was replaced by an algorithm, right? And the app that coordinated labor was kind of an algorithmic manager. Now, that algorithmic manager was also a black box, right? In the sense that for workers who were just working on the street, who were just doing deliveries, you couldn't see anything apart from you roughly knew what the inputs would be. You knew that, like, customers were ordering and you knew what the outputs were, which are that you're getting instructions about what you should do now. But actually the process between the two is completely obscure. So this algorithmic manager was operating in a way that was completely, you know, beyond the realm of understanding for workers on the ground. And there was also another element of this, which was that there was no capacity for compromise built in, right? So, so you're working in a kitchen and all of you are really pissed off by the way the service has gone that evening. And you all want to, you know, complain to the person who's leading the shift that, you know, this is not going well. We're really angry. They might then, they're not guaranteed to, but they might then take account of that and, you know, try and send people home early if they can, try and mollify you, might give you, I've made coffees for everyone, this kind of stuff. There's all these low-level management techniques that supervisors engage in. And actually, with algorithmic management, you get rid of all that capacity for compromise. You get rid of that capacity to turn a blind eye to things. All of those kind of mediating functions are got rid of. And instead, you just have a very hard rule where the algorithm, you know, you can't argue with it. There's no capacity for flexibility built in. So all of this promotes kind of a technical composition where workers actually have very little commitment to the company. There's very little sense that we're all in this together, that you have anything in common with the app or that you have anything in common with the CEO, Will Hsu. Instead, it's very much like a blunt class confrontation because that supervisory level has been completely abolished. So there's no job structure that says, oh, if you work really hard, you might get promoted eventually. You know, there's a hope of advancement. And there's also, like, no hope for flexibility in the tactics of management. And that really, I think that's part of a wider trend. I mean, algorithmic management might discuss it later, but it's increasingly moving to other sectors of the economy. So, you know, if you look at Walmart, for instance, I know you've talked about the People's Republic of Walmart, fantastic book. But basically, like Walmart, your shift scheduling isn't done by a human anymore. It's done by an app which guarantees you only get, I think it's 29 hours a week American workers get before they start to accrue health benefits. So, you know, make sure that the entire fleet never goes over 29 hours a week so they might be able to, you know, like fix a broken leg or whatever. So this tendency towards the automation of supervisory labor, which isn't, you know, supervisory labor isn't in itself productive. So it's just fixed capital being replaced by fixed capital, to use like the technical terms. That automation of supervisory labor is becoming increasingly common across a variety of sectors. And so in the way that, you know, I guess like the technology of the assembly line, for instance, was introduced in Boston in textile manufacture long before it was introduced at Ford. And kind of automotive manufacture, I was interested in getting a look at what does algorithmic management mean and how can we fight against it? And like, how does it change the nature of the struggle on the shop floor? These like early adopter examples, because I think that potentially this will have increasing significance for other sectors as time goes on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's actually kind of funny that like, I don't know, like if some of the last couple of decades can be sort of characterized by this expansion of the professional managerial class and a lot of the kind of like the human face of management sort of emphasis. But then we've reached this point with the algorithmic management thing where the like the Terminator, right? Like the human face just sloughs off and you're left to look at the glittering metallic skull and its red eyes just staring at you.
And also, I mean, there are other factors. I mean, as part of my PhD research, I do some work with Wetherspoons pub workers. And there they have like this very elaborate internal job structure between like an associate, which is the lowest person on the rung, and the actual pub manager who's on 40 grand a year plus a bonus if they hit profit targets. There's about five or six layers in there of like various sub-management tiers. And this has historically, and in many places, continues to kind of pacify people because they have, oh, I have a hope of advancement. And also, you know, I don't have solidarity with someone who's on 10p less an hour than me. But also, like, due to challenges to profitability in that sector, they've actually compressed the wage scale to such a degree that workers who are associates are literally sometimes on 5p less per hour than the person supposedly their immediate manager. So there's all sorts of factors leading to the compression of and collapse of these job structures and, you know, human management systems. And I think increasingly, you know, algorithmic managers are very good at doing efficient calculations and they will increasingly replace humans. It just seems like an obvious result.
Right. So I think, you know, many of our listeners will have had experience with the so-called gig economy. I know I have. I've done piecework of this sort. I've, you know, had some really primitive algorithmic management experience, but I think this is, as you've said, a bit of like a harbinger of things to come. So it's really worth kind of digging into the details of what's going on in these industries because, yeah, we're going to see it pretty much everywhere. And as you mentioned, like this idea of algorithmic management on the one hand, increasing management efficiency, but also increasing class antagonism is something that maybe people can expect to see in their industries in the near future. And the tactics that are developed here may be valuable as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the particular things that studying algorithmic management has really led me to think about is the way in which, so from my perspective, when I was a delivery worker, when I was organizing strikes and we were organizing protests on the street about wages, I very much thought in terms of we've just got to organize everyone who's doing deliveries in the city of Brighton. So, you know, my goal was entirely, I want to organize, you know, 100 plus couriers who are doing deliveries on the streets, who I meet in kitchens, who I meet in these places called zone centers, which are like surplus labor accumulation sites. You know, those were the workers I was really focused on. But actually, in retrospect, I think there's a significant case to be made for the fact that these algorithms are actually the products of other workers, like the technical workers who design and produce these forms of fixed capital are actually, you know, they're just in London, right? There are tech workers who are also, they have a unified class interest. They're not all bosses. And they actually design and create this stuff. So, you know, with examples of things like the Tech Workers Coalition, which I'm sure listeners are probably aware of, or any of these examples of highly skilled technical workers organizing, I think there's a significant thing to think about in terms of how we can forge industrial alliances across the black box and how we can actually make it so that workers who are producing this algorithm and workers who have their work directed by this algorithm see their common interests together, despite the fact they have, you know, dramatically different life circumstances and often very, very different work processes. How do we make them see the community of interest and organize against their common enemy?
Yes, certainly that gets back to what we've just discussed in our previous episode. Right. So, you know, speaking about worker resistance, within the delivery workers themselves, you found that one of the explanations for this supposedly or this apparently spontaneous organization that happened in London was invisible forms of organization, such as the use of WhatsApp. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. So I think we all know from the experience of work that working alongside other people, you develop cooperative relationships, and those cooperative relationships have like two sides to them, right? In the first instance, they help you get the job done. They're of some value to capitalists. I mean, like the whole nature of capitalist production is increasingly everyone cooperates to do the labor that reproduces society. You know, if someone said to me, you've now got to feed yourself, I would have no idea how to do that, right? Where if I was a pre-capitalist peasant, I'd probably have a relatively handy idea how to do that because I didn't just cooperate with other people to let them feed me whilst I mean, in my current life situation, wrote useless books and wrote a PhD. But, you know, people, we have such a complex division of labor, and that's really the fundamental basis of capitalism. The capitalist mode of production relies on the working class cooperating with one another. But then that also has a flip side to it, where we know that those cooperative relationships we have in the workplace are also the point from which we start to organize. So workers basically, there's a guy called Stan Weir, who I'd really recommend people read. He was a docker, he was a merchant sailor and a car factory worker in the US. And wrote really eloquently about the way that workers create their own communities and their own informal work groups. And the existence of these groups is really, they're the microstructure of worker resistance, right? Your group of mates is always going to be the people you go to first when you're pissed off about wages getting cut and you want to organize against it. Now, in a conventional trade union format or a conventional workplace format, that mostly looks like, you know, people chatting at the pub or whatever, where you actually have in real life interactions with one another. But in the context of platform work, because workers are kind of spatially disorganized and you share something of a common workplace, as in you'll often meet in restaurant kitchens or these zone centers I mentioned earlier, and those do create some kind of structure for like IRL interactions, everything also goes on via these big many-to-many communication networks. Which, yeah, stealing from an Italian workerist, Romano Arquati, I called invisible organization. And these big structures, be they, you know, primarily WhatsApp groups, meant that although on the surface it may appear to people as if, you know, the Uber Eats riders waiting outside McDonald's on their phone are just like each doing their own respective thing and not really a community whatsoever, these groups often create huge amounts of community and they play many different functions. So they play kind of practical social functions in the sense that they allow workers to share jokes, to send memes to one another, to, you know, talk about if the roads are icy on that day, to talk about if there are bike thieves about, to share information on, you know, when's the next payday, any of these kind of like small questions, to organize five-a-side football matches. There's a whole jumble of functions performed by these kind of organic social channels. But then when workers decide that they want to mobilize, so if there's, you know, wages have just been too low for too long, they're also the first channels which actually snap into action. And they kind of convert into almost, they kind of replace trade unions and act as strike networks, basically. Mm-hmm. So just to tell the practical story of how in Brighton we got organized, I started working in the company in about September. The details are in the book if people want to look there.
Buy the book, everyone.
Yes. Go
buy
it.
So in about September, I started working at the company. And for the first few months, the wages were actually pretty good because I joined at the start of a huge wave of recruitment where basically demand was quite high. So you'd start work, you'd log in, and then you'd just be going delivery to delivery to delivery constantly. Like there wouldn't be a break. So you could make £12 an hour, you know, £16 an hour for a period just because there was so much demand and there wasn't actually, you know, the labor supply wasn't massive. But delivery noticed this and responded with a huge wave of recruitment, mostly students and young people, which then kind of flooded the labor market. And because you only get, you know, if there's 400 orders to be done by 400 workers, everyone makes one delivery an hour, they all get paid £4 an hour. If there's 400 deliveries to be done by 200 workers, you do two deliveries an hour, you make £8 an hour. So obviously, like having a smaller amount of workers in a piece rate system is much better for the workers. But actually for Deliveroo, it meant that, you know, deliveries would take twice as long. So there was no disincentive for them. They weren't paying you if you weren't doing any work. So they were incentivized to hire and hire and hire and hire. And that process basically meant that wages just nosedived over the winter.
Yes.
As wages went into nosedive, everyone started getting very angry. But it also meant that we were all hanging around a lot of the time. So in the app design at the time, these have actually been eliminated since, but there was a place called a zone center where it basically told you, like, go wait in this square because that's just where we want, you know, it's like a holding pen for surplus labor. But because we were all spending more and more time not doing orders when we were on a shift, we all ended up just waiting there, discussing how pissed off we were, discussing how little money we were making. And you'd kind of roll into the square at the start of a shift and you'd immediately say, look, I'm just massively, like, I've only made £4 an hour for the last couple of nights. I'm so fuming. Has anyone else got the same thing? Everyone starts comparing. And these immediately, it kind of automatically turns into a collective discussion of, like, how bad is this? Oh, we're really fucked off. What should we do? Now, there is potentially no better environment for the wannabe organizer than one of these large, you know, you've got 30, 40 riders standing around discussing how pissed off they are. All you do is start agitating and saying, look, we should all, like, get organized. We should go on strike. We should show them that if, you know, if they don't pay us better, they're not going to get any work done. We can fuck their business up. If we all just stopped work at the same time, the whole app would stop working. And so through having those conversations and producing this bulletin, the Rebel Roo, which kind of talked about the experience of riders who've been on strike elsewhere, over the months from September to about January, we got to the point where we could call a union meeting and get to the point of, you know, actually chatting to people about, shall we set up a branch and actually do this? So in late January, we did that. It was really successful. We had a load of riders there, mostly cyclists. And I was a bit worried about the fact that, you know, how are we going to reach out to moped riders? Because the two components of the workforce are quite different. And we might get a chance to discuss this later. But people, you know, you tend to have young UK-born, often highly educated cyclists, and then often older migrant, English, not their first language, workers on mopeds, and they're working many more hours a week. So there was a division that was reflected in the fact that, you know, I'd recruited lots of people who are a bit like me to join the new union, but we hadn't got through to the migrant workers yet. So I was worried about this, and I was like, we're going to have to take it really slowly. We're going to have to bridge that gap. We're going to have to go bit by bit. But in fact, as soon as we had had this meeting and word got out that we had set up a trade union, it was a WhatsApp group who then took the next step. And this WhatsApp group was made up of Brazilian riders. They called themselves the Brazilaroos.
Incredible.
And the Brazilian riders called a strike for the next week. Right? They were like, oh, great, we have a trade union. Now we go on strike.
Because they already had trade union experience, right? They were...
A lot of them did.
Yeah.
And I mean, fascinating examples that some workers had been through the Arab Spring in Egypt. And, you know, there was a whole diversity of different experiences flowing into it. But these workers knew exactly what to do when a strike was called. So they got straight in touch and were like, yeah, okay, we're calling a strike. And the trade union, us lot, then had to run to keep up and be like, yes, okay, we can do that.
This is so... It's so contrary to, like, the sort of usual narrative, and it's definitely a narrative that I've sort of been guilty of parroting, I guess, that, like, oh, that, like, the working class is completely, you know, dissolved, and, you know, it's this like vanguardist thing of like we the union intellectuals and the I guess the lumpen intellectuals like us on the show, we have to go to the workers and like teach them how to organize. But then you go there, I mean it's kind of narrative that runs through the book, and you go there and they're basically on the cusp of clicking into place already. And it's the in many ways the working class, even the and probably especially the most disempowered and precarious elements of the working class are more advanced than the unions, right? Like, and the unions are surprised when the strikes come about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a danger of getting dragged into a discussion about kind of spontaneism and organisation, which would, a big part of my PhD project is a lengthy discursive examination of Lenin, which is not something I really want to bore the listeners with. But I think it's certainly true that workers have the organic structure already existing through which they can organize themselves, and through their experience of work, usually understand the most effective way in which to shut down production. So workers on a tactical level often have a lot of nous already in place, and it's a case of discovering that nous and kind of working out how we can interact with it as a workers' movement, as kind of what American comrades kind of call a militant minority, and how we can coordinate alongside those switched-on workers. That isn't to say that these workers kind of spontaneously developed an affiliation to socialist ideology, because the depressing thing actually was when I was working with many Brazilian workers, both in Brighton and in London, kind of in their WhatsApp chats, talking about organizing, talking about how we could take the struggle forward, it actually happened to come during the period of the Brazilian election. Mm-hmm. Very frequently, we'd end up with Bolsonaro supporting content being shared into those WhatsApp groups. So there is this contradiction there where a lot of these workers were often illegal migrants taking wildcat strike action alongside kind of leftist radicals. Their support base was entirely coming from the extra parliamentary left in the UK. And they, in their own conceptualization of their role in politics in Brazil, were voting for Bolsonaro, right? Mm-hmm. So there is this profound kind of disjuncture where actually I still think there is a massive role for us as kind of trade union linked intellectuals, as the left generally, that we need to win political arguments with workforces, as well as just like, you know, it's not to say that these workers don't already have valid political ideas of their own, but also that, you know, people don't spontaneously become socialists through the experience of going on strike. And that's a difficult balance to strike, right? But we do need to both, you know, the whole point of a workers' inquiry is the belief that, you know, workers out of their own experience of work have something profound to say about the way in which capitalism today operates and have a perspective, which is the key to our success more generally. But at the same time, it's not to say that, you know, they already, they're just, the sun shines out their arsehole and they already understand everything.
No, totally. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So this discussion of politics, we can take that up and talk a little bit about the relationship of the workers that you encountered with the Labour Party, because the Labour Party was somewhat involved in the strike actions that happened. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. A lot of the engagement of the Labour Party with this process of organisation came through the involvement of trade unions. So, for instance, the Independent Workers of Great Britain, which was my union in Brighton, I was a shop steward, and we, it was our branch that went to John McDonnell that got him to then write a letter supporting our demands, right? Which is obviously, you know, significant support to have the shadow chancellor at the time supporting the, you know, the wildcat strikes of a lot of migrant and angry workers, was, you know, that was significant leverage. But that was kind of coordinated at a higher level. And so things like that, and then also John McDonnell again was very central in organising support for the fast food shutdown, which was this coordinated strike between Wetherspoons workers, McDonald's workers and Uber Eats workers, the first national Uber Eats strike in the UK. That actually was heavily supported by the Labour Party in lots of ways. So lots of local groups were organising their own community pickets of places like McDonald's and going out to support striking food couriers in their area. And, you know, that was momentum branches and Labour branches across the country helping out with that. But again, that kind of high-level communication was done trade union to the party supported by the trade unions. Right. So there was coordination there, but at what you know, how deep that coordination is or how profound it is still, I think, open to question. And certainly something that we might want to develop further in terms of building a political project going forward.
Right, right. So another issue that you sort of touched on was the division between the cyclists and the moped drivers, and then finally the division between those groups and the white-collar workers that were working for Deliveroo. I think that you did manage to the workers in general did manage to bridge those gaps a little bit, but do you think that the solidarity between the cyclists and the moped workers was kind of an enduring thing, or was it a temporary thing?
It's often a very, very temporary alliance based on a perceived community of interest. So like when everyone's wages are low, people cooperate. But then also because the black box can operate in ways that people don't understand, that can also give rise to mutual suspicion. So in the Brighton example, we basically organized really well. We had a big strike. We had a series of demonstrations. And then there was a crisis when basically cyclists, all of our work started drying up, but the mopeds were still fine. In fact, the mopeds were a bit better off.
Right.
What people worked out was, or what people guessed was, that there had been a difference in the weighting of like who was getting more orders between mopeds and cyclists, which meant that basically all of the like long-term cyclists got driven out of the job, like kind of informally made redundant because their hours just dropped through the floor, whereas the moped riders were still fine, right? And that solidarity between the two groups, which had been the foundation of our campaign, which had been the foundation of how we actually had leverage in the workplace, might have been, I mean, I can only ever say might, but might have been broken by the intentional manipulation of the labor process at the level of the algorithmic manager. So whilst these coalitions can emerge and often do emerge, and it's remarkable, you know, when you look at instances of workers in food platforms getting organized, I mean, everywhere all over the UK, the scope of this stuff is really remarkable. Little random towns like places like Worthing or, you know, just everywhere where these platforms operate, there is usually at least one example of self-organized strike action that has emerged in the wake of them operating in that city. There are often these coalitions come up. Right, they do regenerate, but they're not really long-lasting and permanent. Some of the barriers to that are things like you may literally not speak the same language as the people you're on strike alongside. Like, you know, try and have a political conversation with someone, or try and have like an organizing conversation where you're like, you should become a shop steward. You obviously, you know, people look up to you, you're a natural leader, but it's very difficult to kind of have that chat if you don't speak Brazilian Portuguese or, you know, whatever language they're talking in, and they don't speak English. One of the major reasons that migrant workers end up in this job is because the app will operate in whatever language your phone is set to. So right. You don't actually have to speak a word of English to do the work. That really can be a significant barrier between the two sides of the workforce. But then that's not to say that in moments of mobilization and struggle, that coalition doesn't reemerge.
Right. That point about the algorithm sort of manipulating the relations between members of the workforce also just kind of brings to mind what I've seen in journalism with the sort of changes in workforce composition that are driven by changes in Facebook or Google's algorithms, and the sort of desperate attempts to interpret what the algorithm wants. And how the organization can follow it. I think this is something that we probably will see across many different sectors.
And also it can really, like, political organization can be destroyed by it. So, I mean, I know friends who, like, do stuff like make memes for Facebook audiences. Mm-hmm. And in the 2017 general election, it's, like, hugely successful. I mean, you're talking of the organic reach getting up into the tens of millions, right? Really, really effective content production strategy. And it basically got you audiences that you would have to pay tens or hundreds of thousands of pounds to get anywhere near in a different media environment. I mean, like 30 million pairs of eyeballs over a month is just an astronomical amount of money. But then in the 2019 general election, because the algorithms changed, that project is completely fucked, right? And it gets, you know, a fifth of, if that, the engagement that had previously, because Facebook has realized, firstly, that political parties will pay a lot of money for advertising. And if you take away the free stuff, they're more likely to spend budget on it. But also it's worked out that, you know, these concerns about fake news and stuff, that's just user-generated content getting organic reach. So in that sense, they can completely change the terrain on which you fight an election. And I think that is partly what we saw in the 2019 general election. Just Facebook's algorithm was different, right? And that makes a profound difference when many people, their major source of news is Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Suspicious that it would change at around that time. You know, I mean, who wants to take a bet that these fucking ghouls at Facebook are taking money from the Tories to, like, not just to run Tory ads, but to explicitly fucking de-run the other stuff, you know?
And did you see the stuff about the dark pages? So they had a load of Facebook pages, like the campaign against Corbynism was one of them. And what was the one? The capitalist worker was one of them.
Oh, I did see that, yeah. Well, who's going to, like, who wants to bet that those are run by, like, the Pinochet Institute for Fiscal Reform or whatever, behind the scenes, you know?
It's people who are involved with the Adam Smith Institute, which will not surprise anyone.
Incredible.
The Adam Smith Institute, the heart of workers' culture.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And it was some guy with, like, a ridiculous, it was like toffee-nosed, like, whatever, the most ridiculous name running the capitalist worker thing. They have to register. But these pages were spending tens of thousands of pounds on incredibly aggressive attack ads, often, like, completely fake, just like Jeremy Corbyn wants to shoot British troops or whatever. And the spend was, the reason that people like me and you were seeing them, Shane, because they were directing it at our base, they were directing it at the Labour base, with the intention of just demobilizing young voters and not getting them out, right? And they spent huge amounts on this that, you know, that kind of spend is not registered with the Electoral Commission as Tory party spend. And, like, I think the really damaging part of it was that they only got deactivated by Facebook as soon as the election was over. Right, prior to that, they let them spend all the money. Like, I'm sure they flagged them because people were reporting them, but then they never actually did anything until the election was over, and then bang, they took them down.
I mean, surely Facebook knows which side its bread is buttered on, right? Like, it's like outright fucking collusion and electoral fiddling. Grotesque.
It's kind of like living our social lives through these platforms that we don't control is a bad thing.
And then, like, the fact that they're so, like, it's like you can't... Like, how do you counter that, right? Like, what's the counter tactic? You can't, like, because it's all targeted and it's all this algorithmic stuff. You're kind of literally not sharing that space with the people you'd want to get to. With, like, hey, ignore the ad you just saw. It's a load of bullshit. Like, it's never going to get delivered to them, right?
Well, I think what you do is you go on Twitter and you tweet about how pissed off about it you are.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we're kind of deviating into electoral strategy here, but I think this is where we might think about the role of the workers' movement going forward, is that people own that kind of air war is only really effective in an environment where people are completely isolated from, you know, in real life communities, right? Where, you know, if you are a boomer whose Facebook is full of, like, pages that, like, do you remember what life used to be like when it was better and there were less migrants? And you just, like, are sharing photos of, like, Britain in the 1950s and shouting about birth.
They've tricked their brains into sundowning decades early through that kind of stuff.
I mean, like, can you imagine what the next wave of dementia is going to look like? It's just people in their mid-50s just going.
No, there's a crisis for the NHS, right, in the next couple of decades. It's just, like, screen-poisoned boomers just going through the...
This might be the most profound example of turkeys voting for Christmas that I've ever... What slice of the population desperately, desperately needs the NHS, desperately needs a care service that can actually look after them? And they've just voted to, like, throw themselves into the sea.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a self-solving problem at some level, right? You know?
Yeah, yeah. You make the NHS eventually die. But there's this thing, I think, where actually the role of things like organising in workplaces, organising in communities around rent and those kind of things, that you can actually get into people's lives and have organic interactions with them. So what Labour's campaign was premised on over the course of the 2019 general election was, like, let's have 2 million conversations with people to convince them to vote Labour. But those conversations only occurring at the point of, like, now you're getting bombarded with negative media and I'm trying to persuade you that actually, no, Jeremy Corbyn didn't say it was bad, that the bridge terrorist attackers were shot, or that that child actually did lie on the floor of an NHS hospital. That kind of interaction actually is probably less effective than a long-term interaction where someone says, oh, do you know, well, when my mate was getting evicted, this load of people went out and picketed the letting agents and stopped that eviction happening. And they are now connected to this organization called the Labour Party, who say they have our interests in mind. And, oh, well, let me think about potentially voting for them, right? So the role of economic organizations, things like renters unions and workers unions, you know, the role of doing things like organizing at Deliveroo is, in the long term, we might be able to change people's voting behavior. Yes, I mean, that's obviously a good thing. But then in addition to changing people's voting behavior, we reduce their reliance on these channels that are completely dominated by the ruling class and start them to see that they have agency in their own lives, right? So that you're not just living life vicariously through a screen of children playing in the 1950s, but you have a sense of, like, I can do things in my own life which will improve it. And I have concrete relationships with other people in my community. I'm not completely isolated. And so I believe that actually a movement that wants to totally transform society has a snowball's chance in hell. Because until people can really look at that in their everyday life and believe it, you know, we're not going to win.
Yep. Wonderful. So what you're saying is it's time to log off. And go outside and, like, look at the sun,
right,
or whatever.
It's time to put, like, the reverse of a child lock on a computer. Everyone needs to go onto their dad's laptop and install, like, a boomer lockout mechanism.
Yep. That's going to be a reversal of fortunes, right? Like, instead of clearing viruses off their fucking bullshit when you go home for Christmas, you're going to have to install as much fucking malware as possible. Grim, yeah. So there's an interesting thread running through the book as well about, like, it's adjacent to the algorithmic management stuff and the kind of the composition of the workforce, right? That, like, it's a, like, the whole thing of, like, capitalism creating its own gravediggers is becoming, like, even more intense, right? That, like, they use the black box algorithms, they use the algorithmic management to like, make the workforce more remote from the higher levels of the company, but then that leaves the workers alone, you know, to play the forbidden music and just chat to each other, and, like, they're out from under the eye of Sauron in that way.
Yeah, that's a really important point that I didn't make earlier, I realize now, but yeah, they can't crack down. The algorithmic manager doesn't really have a repression mode, like, unless they do what I said earlier with the division between mopeds and cyclists.
We'll delete this part of the conversation in that case and not give them the idea.
But they don't have the chance to overhear you in the workplace talking about trade unionism, right? And that is a really significant difference. Yeah, sorry for interrupting, Chen.
No, it's cool. And then, like, but all these things are tied together, right? And it's also that, like, the stuff they invent to brutalize the working class also ends up being, like, the foundations for the, like, much more fierce resistance. And then also, like, the comms technology that all this is predicated on as a disempowering force is also kind of an empowering force in this weird dialectical tension, right? And it seems, yeah, like, this seems like wildly unstable stuff, right? That, like, these very conditions, and I guess, like, also the Weatherspoon's workers, like, having their like, pay scales compressed to the point where, you know, nominally you're a supervisor, but, like, in practice, you know, like, you're not making any more money than the other guy. So it's like, when capital gets its way, you know, it's kind of tying a noose for itself. Well, hopefully, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember. It's in Beverly Silber's amazing book, Forces of Labor, which I really recommend people read. But she chats in there about how someone, I think it might be Habermas, but I can't remember, theorizes the idea that capitalism is constantly swinging between crises of profitability and crises of legitimacy, right? Either they've developed, you know, like the social democracy in the post-war period, they've developed a system whereby they've actually got a, you know, the material basis for a mass compromise around some form of, like, continuing exploitation, but this is making them unprofitable, so they need to swing the other way. Or you have this crisis where, you know, there's no legitimacy because people don't have any buy into the system. I think what we actually see at the moment is the coincidence of these two varieties, where you have a crisis of profitability. I mean, we all know that globally capitalism is not in a good place, continue to get, you know, less so over time. But at the same time, you've also got these real problems where people are being pushed into very difficult life circumstances in the UK at the moment. So, you know, you're talking about this workforce, the delivery, you know, the food platform workforce, are often people who are really fighting to gain access to the means of subsistence in order to reproduce themselves. And, you know, someone who works for Uber Eats, who drives for 60 hours a week to try and get enough money to feed their children, you know, that person is very desperate. And actually, the ongoing trend we're seeing at the moment is this real reduction in quality of life for workers in Britain. And that's not, you know, that's not to be accelerationist about things in kind of that misuse of the term accelerationism that you should be mad. But it's not to be catastrophist about things and say that everything getting worse is ultimately better for us as a revolutionary force. But it is to say that just inevitably the direction of travel here is towards, there is a massive offensive ongoing against the working class. As of yet, there has been no sustained fight back. And so there will just be a gradual erosion, or not so gradual in some cases, of our conditions of life. And that will polarise responses to it. And I think that, you know, when you see workers kick off now, it will not look like strikes in, you know, the 1990s or even necessarily strikes like the 1980s. You're going back to kind of, you know, the early history of the US labour movement, where strikes are violent confrontations. I mean, that's more likely what we're going to see in the coming period if, you know, we do get a revitalization of the workers.
Right. So one thing that we haven't exactly touched on yet is the fact that these delivery workers or workers for many other platforms are, as you said before, classified as sort of independent contractors. And this gives them more room for maneuver in taking strike action. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So I kind of played this down in the book because many people, when they analyze the situation in platform capitalism from kind of a soft left perspective, get really hung up on this employment status thing and then get no like they will immediately just be like, oh, but wouldn't this all be better if people were classified as workers and therefore they would get access to, you know, statutory sick pay, or, you know, as if that is the magical solution and people who are in full-time employment are not also having a really shit time of it.
Right.
So yeah. I didn't want to like massively foreground discussion of this, but where it does become really relevant is, I think, on the question of our trade union laws, basically. So the UK has incredibly draconian trade union laws by any standards, you know, that like we actually have no protection to strike in law. You just have an insurance against being sued. And with the passing of things like the 2016 Trade Union Act, you know, we're increasingly getting really, really fucked over, whereby to actually go on strike, you've got to beat these turnout thresholds. You've got to give lots of notice. And if you actually go through this full process of giving notice and winning turnout thresholds and the rest, not only does it cost the union a huge amount of money for something that may just get injuncted by the courts at the last minute, as was the case recently with the Communication Workers Union, who I think got some like astonishing ballot success, really, really high percentage. 97.1 is floating around in my head, and then got that ballot taken away from them because some of them had posted them in groups. But that basically like, that process also gives your employer so much notice that when you actually do go on strike, they can just, you know, reorganize production to basically get rid of the disruptive effect.
Yeah.
Whereas the remarkable thing that we see about food platform strikes is because people aren't employees, they don't have to go through any kind of legalistic process. As long as they're organized, they can go on strike. They don't have to give any notice. They can do it immediately. And that means that their strikes are always wildcats and are always highly disruptive, because the company won't know anything is happening. Workers will be chatting through these WhatsApp chats, and then one evening the entire platform will collapse in X city, right? And that kind of organization is profoundly effective, because if there's no workers doing deliveries, you know, the whole thing falls apart. It's a logistical system in which the workers actually have a huge amount of power, and also because they've been unbound from employment law, have the huge ability to exercise it. Because everything that the neoliberals invested in, all kind of the Thatcherite moves that were made to make strike action harder to take away our fundamental democratic liberties in the workplace, they were all tied to the category of employee, right? So actually, it got so excited and got so ahead of itself, and that, oh, we can actually just abolish like this minimal legalistic convention of employment and just get rid of it entirely. Well, they've actually also got rid of their own protections. Right. So as you were saying earlier, Sean, it is this dialectical thing where every development has sides, has opportunities for both sides in it. Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Yeah. And I mean, like it's I think it's the thing you mentioned earlier, and it's definitely mentioned in the book that like, yeah, when the management and the sort of Tories make such, you know, moves of like throwing you overboard, you know, it's like, well, you know, why would we give a shit about you? You know, it's like we've got no fucking investment in this. So the disempowerment I mean, I really hope that we see this reconstitution of a proper sort of workers' movement and really take this stuff forward. And it's like, well, you know, if you fuck us over, better be ready for the fucking backlash, you know?
Yeah, I got an amazing quote from there was a first strike in Brighton in February, called by the Brasileiros, and then there was another strike later that year in November when I wasn't working for the platform anymore. And I went along to kind of see how it was going and support the picket line. And I was chatting to a worker who I hadn't seen before. And I was basically asking him, you know, like, why are you doing this? I was trying to understand his specific motive, like, why was he on strike? And he came up with an amazing line where he said, basically, look, either we fight or they fuck us.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The top right there. There's no further explanation needed. Either we fight or they fuck. And it was like, that's that is exactly it.
Amazing. Yeah. So has much changed since the book came out? Has there been further developments or any interesting sort of stuff that, like, if you were writing the book now, would be included?
So I think the really important thing to note here is that this is not there are not big set-piece battles between workers and management in this sector. Instead, it's much more like a constantly ongoing guerrilla war. There's not going to be a national renegotiation of a contract. It tends to be that, like, fires just flare up everywhere and in kind of short bursts, and workers don't necessarily generate long-lasting organisational structures out of them, but they might win short-term concessions. So, for instance, like in Brighton, one of our demands was a hiring freeze, right? We basically said, like, stop hiring new riders so that as people drop off through turnover, we'll start getting a better and better rate because there'll be, you know, more deliveries per rider. Now, we were successful in winning that, but actually in terms of, like, was that communicated? Was it maintained long-term? It's really difficult to say. And then also the way that the piece rate works, there are now all sorts of delivery doesn't pay flat rates anymore. It now just plays a multiplier. So it can, you know, they can basically say, oh, you've got an extra boost now, so your wages in this area are going to go up 20p per delivery for the next couple of weeks. But they'll never admit that's a result of strike action, and they can actually withdraw it at any time.
Right.
That means that the fact that none of these count in official statistics, and they're barely ever monitored by local newspapers because local newspapers have been shot to bits, basically means it's very hard to keep track of what's actually going on. Like, there will be strikes organised that I have never heard about and will not have made it into the book just because, you know, I didn't know they happened, because they've been localised to, like, all the Uber Eats workers who work from this one McDonald's, like all 15 of them stopped working at once. And it's clearly a strike over boost rates. But, you know, it will never get reported as such. So this means that it's actually, it's very difficult to keep track of everything. From what I can tell, we've had a reduction in intensity after kind of the wave of 2016 to, I would say, 18, 19. That was a really significant wave. And it appears that the intensity is now less, but kind of qualitatively different, in the sense that the IWGB now has significantly more resources to attempt to organise delivery work and are going about attempting to construct a long-term form of organization. Because really the problem here is, like, how do you bind these workers together? So they're really pissed off and they want to spontaneously go on strike, but, like, how do you have a meeting 2 weeks after where you have, you know, representatives of each sector of the workforce come together to develop a further strategy, right? That's really the question that people have been trying to solve. And so at the moment, I think we're kind of in a period of experimentation where, because there aren't so many fires being lit all over the place, we're trying to work out how that form can kind of change to incorporate people in the longer term, and how you can develop durable institutions out of these individual wildfires, as it were.
Right. So just to touch on one other point in your book, which I think ties in with this, you sort of conclude with a few different future scenarios. So we kicked off this show with four futures, of course, but we got three here. There's the scenario of the bosses sort of winning out, kind of liberal compromise or more worker-led scenario. Could you just talk a little bit about the futures you see as possibilities going forward?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is where you commit the cardinal sin talking about the future. There's actually been a development I didn't entirely anticipate, which I'll talk about in a sec. But in terms of the bosses winning out, I think what we've really got to think about is the way that they want to reorganize this is entirely provisional on whether this bubble will hold out. Because obviously, like, we're all aware that huge amounts of surplus capital, because of low profitability, are being pumped into, kind of these unicorn ideas, where people are trying to, you know, just come up with the next Apple or whatever. You don't need to look at like the SoftBank Futures Fund or whatever. There's huge amounts of money getting driven into these sectors. And to be honest, like, none of them seem capable of turning a profit. So Deliveroo, not too long ago, completely withdrew from Germany because they realized they were just spunking loads of money up the wall. They just like ran away from the entire country. And coincidentally, because the workers were not given significant rights, didn't actually pay them any redundancy pay. But what their plans are, and I think we've got to take this with a pinch of salt, because these plans might just be an attempt to prevent investors from panicking that they're never going to get returns on their million, are basically to automate through production and delivery. So there's a phenomena whereby these platforms have been investing more and more in places that we call dark kitchens, right? Which are basically like shipping containers in industrial areas of town, often industrial estates, where you, like, if you're a restaurant, you can hire some extra capacity and do a delivery only kitchen where you, no one can come in and sit down. It just all goes out via these platforms. And sometimes there's like a special rate offered or whatever. Now they want to turn these kitchens increasingly into like distribution hubs. So it will go from a decentralized logistical model where you have like lots of restaurants and lots of homes to be delivered to scattered all over a city into more of a hub and spoke model where you kind of have these dark kitchens operating as logistical hubs in the same sense as like an Amazon warehouse, where fixed capital in the form of robots will produce food. I mean, it remains to be seen like how effective that technology is. But yes, we'll produce food for a fraction of the cost of a human prepared meal. And then they want to put them in these little drone robots that then help, like, do the deliveries. Mm-hmm. So these little drone robots, I heard from a speaker at a logistics sector conference. I went to like a business logistics conference. And one of the people presenting one of these drones said, oh, you know, pavements, you've got to look at them around our city. They're really underutilized logistical infrastructure. No one's making any money off pavements. What if we could come up with drones that roll along them and do deliveries? So this is exactly what lots of different companies have been investing in. Amazon have a significant stake in a project. And basically, they want these drones to roll around and completely replace the human beings doing the orders. So they want kind of fully automated luxury food delivery, is what I call it in the book. The development I actually hadn't completely foreseen, which is now increasingly obvious, is that once you've got a generic hub and spoke distribution network, you don't just have to do food. You can start to do other things. So Amazon have a very, very significant stake in Deliveroo. They, in fact, just gave them a huge loan to buy them over. And they basically, I think, will start to, already in cities like Berlin, they have this 1 hour delivery thing.
Yep.
I think they'll start to look at using these kind of like drone dark kitchen hubs to do basically all forms of urban logistics. So actually these food platforms will just become a like last leg delivery option in cities. That's kind of what they're aiming for. Now that would, of course, involve making the entire workforce redundant, probably with zero payment. And a significant transition in business model. So there are serious challenges. And I think it's not unlikely that if you did make, you know, thousands upon thousands of already very precarious people who are very close to the breadline, redundant across the UK, this might be their only access to income. You know, they might be a migrant worker who can't prove their right to work, who's renting an account off someone else so that they can do the job. You know, this might be the only job they could ever get in the UK in order to support their family. Those people are going to go out and they're going to smash the crap out of those stupid little delivery drones.
those robots are going to get murked. Like, every one of them is going to end up in the scrap heap. Like, this.
Imagine, like, drunk at the pub and just seeing, like, R2-D2 scuttling along with someone's, like, Happy Meal. It's not going to work.
Apparently, I saw a thing, it was probably in the last couple of months, but, like, there was, I know some company was running this kind of shit in California. It was these little dump and trash can robots.
I know what you're going to say here.
But, like, it turned out that, like, they're not actually automated. It's like a warehouse full of kids in Bosnia that are piloting them remotely or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was Colombia. But yeah, it's $2 an hour micro work. Yeah, as with so much of what's like smart and brilliant about the new economy, it's actually just people in the global south doing this
stuff.
Shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us right back to that flying cars fucking essay way back at the start, right? That, like, this automation thing is really a fucking smokescreen to obscure labor conditions, and particularly to obscure people from the global south or whatever, and just like, holy shit, like, and people lap this shit up. Like fucking Wired puts out an article and it's like, wow, we're going to automate all this stuff. And it's like, come on, guys, look behind the curtain, for fuck's sake. Like, don't fall for it, you mooks, you know?
Well, it also turns a workforce which is, like, location-specific and has a lot of leverage into a workforce that is kind of distanced and can be replaced very easily. So there's a huge shift in power dynamic implied there. Those workers, if that was the system adopted by these delivery robots, those workers would be the ones producing all the value, but they might... I mean, I'm sure they would come up with a form of collective action to defend their interests, but it might potentially be less effective. So there's all sorts of transitions implied by that. But we've gone on for a bit about the wet dreams of Will Shu. I think the other alternative, and this is where it gets really interesting, is kind of the liberal reform model. So I, since publishing the book, I've talked to lots of people from kind of, you know, cross-party think tanks and lots of broadly, you know, people with good intentions who want to kind of make very micro changes to the way in which the gig economy works. And, you know, they've been like, can we consult you on a report where you give us, you know, three steps as to how the gig economy can work for workers? And okay, so first we're going to abolish the value form.
Full communization now.
So we're going to progressively transition ownership of the means of production to workers. But what is very interesting is the vacuity of these attempts. I particularly quote the guy in the book, you guys might know him, Tim O'Reilly, who wrote WTF, What the Future?
Oh, no.
Worst kind of Silicon Valley billionaire guy, philanthropist, has apparently turned up to Bernie fundraisers and thinks he's really, really cool and the shit and is going to solve for the workers. And in this book, WTF, he just comes out with completely, like, nonsensical rubbish, really profoundly, profoundly dumb stuff. And so I think that illustrates for me that, like, so one of his phrases, we've got to play the game of business like people matter, which is quite interesting in the sense of, like, the point of the game of business is that people don't matter, only experience value matters. But also, right. why did he say like people matter?
That's an interesting slip, right?
You think people matter. That's very.
Let's pretend that people matter. Yeah, exactly, right?
But yeah, I think there's complete vacuity where basically the compromise solutions on the table here are very, very limited. The idea that there's enough profit to share in this industry to make, like, a harmonious social democratic solution are broadly out of reach. The situation facing these largely urban surplus populations who end up doing this work is basically immiseration, or, you know, there is no viable way out that maintains social relations and doesn't immiserate them.
Yeah, right. So... if I could just interrupt for a moment, one thing that you do talk about in the book is that many people describe the delivery workers as owning the means of production and sort of, you know, using those to sort of self-exploit or whatever.
Well, like a bike. it's not the means of production.
Exactly. But what you say is that this is more like the workers own the means of subsistence. And I think that kind of connects into this whole dimension of immiseration that you were just talking about.
Yeah. Well, you actually have to provide more and more in order to be able to turn up for work in the first place, right? Like, instead of just feeding yourself breakfast and, like, clothing yourself, you've also got to turn up with, like, a bike, a moped, you know, things that used to be fixed capital that had to be bought by the company has then been basically outsourced to you as your means of subsistence. And, yeah, this idea that workers own the means of production is completely false. And basically, a lot of this book consists of go back and read Marx again, everyone. There's a lot of good stuff in there.
Yes.
But so then I think one of the compromise options, which potentially has more, like, people on the radical left tend to give it more space, is this idea of platform cooperatives, whereby people say, yes, you already own the means of production or the means of subsistence. You already have your bikes. All you need is an app, and then you can outcompete these companies and just, like, cooperatively own them as workers. I think this is a complete fallacy for a number of reasons. I mean, first, often people underestimate the amount of work required to maintain the major, you know, the algorithmic manager is very complex. But just think, because it's like on a computer, then like computer people can do it quite easily, and you just need like three engineers and a
few
weeks.
It's just like Excel. What the fuck's wrong? Like, it's just you put it in the spreadsheet, it does the fucking thing. You know, it's easy.
So sometimes there are underestimations of that amount of effort. But also, I think, like, fundamentally, their vision here for how you destroy platform capitalism is you outcompete it. And you're not going to outcompete these platforms in how much they're willing to immiserate labor or how much venture capital they're willing to spunk up the wall to take your consumer base away from you and pay your workers more. Like, they outcompete each other. So I was in Amsterdam talking to some workers there, delivery workers, and they were basically saying, you know, we each work for about 7 apps. They all go at the same time and they're all trying to win the workers over to their app. So they each pay like competitive bonuses to try and get you to work for their app. Now, that only exists so long as the struggle for like monopoly control of a city is ongoing. As soon as that ends, obviously wages drop to immiseration levels. Yeah. But that just proves exactly what they would do to a platform cooperative. They compete the hell out of you. And also, we've got examples with like attempted Uber cooperatives in the US, where Uber's been banned from the city for a certain period of time, and this cooperative has flourished. And as Uber has been reintroduced, they've absolutely smashed the cooperative to bits.
Yeah, I think it's a thing we've sort of brought up on the show before, but like this thing of like, oh, the answer to the horrors of capitalism is yet another startup.
Just... Cooperatives may do like worthwhile things in terms of showing workers they can self-organize and that actually like there is not. Genius, that bosses aren't complete geniuses, right? Like Elon Musk is not actually very clever, right? That might be a worthwhile demonstration of a cooperative, but I think that, and you know, and for some people it might create a nice niche in the economy where they're not having to, you know, be completely immiserated, and good on them for that. But it's not a large scale solution. It's not a replacement for class struggle. And this is where kind of my preferred solution comes in, which I like to call platform expropriation. Where basically I think that if you look at the social use value of these jobs. So we haven't really talked about it, but like who actually uses a company like Deliveroo? So the advertising will tell you it's people who want a urban luxury consumption experience, but for some kind of unspoken reason don't want to leave their house. So they want really expensive, really nice sushi or something, but they don't actually want to go anywhere. Now, actually, I think what all this reveals is basically the lie that people who tend to use these companies want to have some kind of like, they basically can't feed themselves because they're exhausted or depressed or hungover or are experiencing any number of one of the maladies of late capitalism to which office workers are increasingly subject. You know, they are socially isolated. They don't have, you know, someone who, you know, if they're a couple, both partners work jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Where white-collar workers are increasingly experiencing a real crisis of social reproduction. And these platforms, they don't offer them a new kind of service. A lot of these white-collar workers could just go to Lidl and buy a load of takeaways, and that would do much the same job. I mean, God knows that like a pizza that's been bounced around in a cardboard bag for 15 minutes is not particularly nice. But it does offer them a high social capital way of kind of eating. And this allows them to solve a crisis by saying, I'm not in a crisis at all, right? Mark Fisher talked about this idea of responsabilization, right? Everyone thinks everything that's wrong in their life is their own fault at the moment, right? And that's particularly the case with mental health. And so I think often like workers experience the fact that they're really struggling to get by, but they don't want to admit that to themselves. So this is the high social capital solution. It's like you're not depressed and like standing around in your dressing gown, not having shaved for a few days on a Sunday, you've just drunk away the whole weekend because you're awful. You're not depressed. You're having a luxury experience, right? And this was the truth you saw on the doorstep. When you're doing deliveries, you delivered the cheapest thing on the menu to people who looked like they were having a bit of a shit time. That was basically what you did, right? Like this idea of, you know, with the exception of a few square miles in London where you might actually deliver £40 sushi, it very rarely happens. And if you are doing deliveries to offices, it's usually because people are working late and that's being used as a perk to exploit them further, where it's like, yeah, we'll buy you dinner if you stay for another like 2 hours, and the dinner is worth a fraction of their hourly wage, right? So actually, you know, what do these platforms do? Well, the fundamental point is they are care platforms, I think. And so when we think about how we want to transform them, we've got to think about how can we unleash that care functionality. Like how we produce food for each other is the most fundamental way of, you know, really caring for another, I think. Anyway, I'm a big food person. I always think that you really know someone when you've eaten with them, when you cook for someone. You know, there's a reason that's special for us. Everyone thinks about the food they ate as a child, or many people think about the food they ate as a child as like a special point of emotional connection with them, because it's such a primary care thing. So in my head, when we talk about how, you know, workers taking ownership of the means of production through a process of social revolution, I mean, that's the underlying premise of this, is that we're going to take all their stuff, not pay them any money for it. Will Shu is going to run away crying. His golden billionaire nest egg has just exploded in his face.
We're coming for that toothbrush, assholes.
Yeah. We're going to take the toothbrush and we're going to use it to scrub a dark kitchen. But that kind of process, how can we repurpose the thing that we get out of it, the platform we get out of it, under workers' control? And I think we've got to think about these infrastructures as part of, hopefully, like a universal basic service package where people can be fed. And, you know, if you are, you know, if you're suffering with a mental illness, if you're elderly, if you're disabled, you know, this can be offered as a care service to lots of people. And we can turn those dark kitchens from these kind of insular, horrible places where people are just exploited and do deliveries into kind of hubs of social reproduction. We could have communal kitchens where, you know, food is going out on delivery, but also food is being provided. And you can use the purchasing power of those kitchens to do specific kinds of environmentally friendly. You can encourage vegan patterns of eating so that we reduce the environmental load of how we're feeding ourselves in cities. There's all kinds of ways that you can think about using this platform as part of a communalization of everyday life in contemporary cities. And I think for me, like, that goal has to kind of orientate us, because we're not just trying to fight for better wages here. This is not an economic struggle. And fundamentally, this book isn't even really about Deliveroo, right? Like, this is really like one way into chatting about how we think about and rebuild a workers' movement, which has as its end goal, not just like the raising of wages, but the abolition of the wage system.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I found that, that part of the book absolutely inspirational, that like, because I read it and I was like, I've got to quit my job and do this. Like, just imagine those communal kitchens with the delivery stuff all sorted out, and you get your, you know, you pay in your X amount of pounds per week, and you get your 14 meal tokens, or whatever, and they just show up, and it's all great. And you're right, like it's care, right? Like it's caring for ourselves and each other, and like the fact that all this fucking vampire capital is inserted into the middle of that process is horrific.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely going to be my job under socialism. It's going to be like, you know, I'll go back and work for Deliveroo all over again. You know, it wasn't too bad spending hours on my bike just like riding around the city. But if you just got to do it in a way that like really made the world better, I'm straight back on.
And like I recognized myself in that notion of, oh, you know, that's that you're just getting it because it's a choice between, like, you know, in your family, you're wiped out after a bad day at work, whatever, and it's either Cocoa Pops for dinner or it's order in on Deliveroo. And yeah, you know what, we'll get that. But it's nothing like what the fucking marketing makes it out to be. Like, it's like we're not being, you know, this incredible bohemian lifestyle. It's just we feel like shit. And it's like literally it's either we have a bowl of Cocoa Pops for dinner or it's going to be, you know, actual food and it's going to be delivered. And I was like, I just didn't realize about myself until I read that passage, and I was like, holy shit, that is entirely on the money, you know?
Sorry. Yeah.
No, well, that's great. Yeah.
I recognize it from, I've ordered, I mean, people always ask me, oh, should we boycott the platform? Like, no, because then people won't get any work to do at all. But also, like, whenever I've ordered off these platforms, it's been in that state of exhaustion. I mean, yeah, I think the size of these companies and their capacity for growth really tells you something about what's going on in certain sections of the British working class.
Yeah, I guess you really quite intelligently observe in the book that this is sort of like the next wave of the ready-made meal. Right. Like this is the next form of that, where the ready made meal was kind of it exploded as a consequence of the reorganization of the workforce under neoliberalism. And what we have with Deliveroo is more or less another form of that, another way to allow you to work longer and spend less time on care labor in the home.
Mm hmm. And like they still can't turn a fucking profit. Like if this is the best capitalism can come up with right now, order the fucking gravestone because it's going to be over soon. Because like this is the glittering fucking future apparently according to these, and they can't turn a goddamn profit anywhere. Even when they externalize all their fucking costs onto like, oh, you have to buy all your own equipment and stuff. It's like, holy shit! Like this is on its last legs. If this is the absolute best it can do, you know. Well, hopefully, who knows? Maybe hopefully.
My favorite. Fact on this front is so Uber Eats is apparently Uber are very excited about this, more profitable than Uber in some 50 cities. And yeah. You're like, guys, you're not really selling the rest of the Uber platform to me.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So is there anything else we should cover before we wrap up?
Well, I think it's also important to, you know, like, what's the point of. We've said we want to rebuild a workers' movement that can kind of aim for the abolition of the wage system as well as just like concrete improvements in people's everyday lives. But I think the challenge for us going forward is to conceptualize what that looks like in new economic conditions. So concretely, like, you know, we know what the mass strike looked like in Russia in 1905, but fundamentally we're operating on completely different terrain. And there is a challenge ahead of us for, like, how do we think through what the mass strike looks like in advanced economies in the 2020s? Right? Because fundamentally, we've had things like, you know, a lot of manufacturing has been outsourced. We've got just-in-time production. There are all these like, fundamental changes in the way that we get access to commodities to reproduce ourselves, and also the system gets access to, you know, the value it needs to reproduce itself. For me, I think like reconceptualizing that workers' movement, that's really the challenge ahead of us. But it's not a passive challenge for like someone else or like a sort of like chin stroke. All the stuff in this book, like the insights in this book are not, you know, because I sat back and had a really good think about things. Like maybe like Adorno, you can do that. Most of us sadly are not Adorno, or perhaps like luckily are not Adorno. So I think it's also like, if I can end it with anything, it's that we have this challenge, all of us, not only to write books about things that we find interesting, but also like practically, you know, the method here was a workers' inquiry where I went and did a job and talked to people and tried to understand things from the workers' point of view in order to get some kind of like wider systemic insights about how capitalism as a system is operating in our contemporary context. But everyone has that kind of agency. And this is not, you know, I end the book slightly emotionally chatting about Rosa Luxemburg being locked in prison and how, you know, the challenges ahead of us are doubtless really, really severe. But we have to be that militant minority that turns things around. And, you know, the labour movement and the workers' movement has never grown in straight lines. It's never been just like a gradual upward progress where like an extra 15 workers join a union every second for, you know, at a time. It is these periodic explosions. You know, you have these massive spikes in membership and strike numbers every now and again when political conditions are right and people mobilize and see their fight with their bosses as a fight that it's up to them and they can win. And we're the people who have to play a role in making that happen, you know, whether it be in your own workplace, whether it be engaging to support people in workplaces near wherever you are in the world. That agency is in our hands. And so the thing I, you know, the real thing I'm shooting for at the end of the book is to give people a sense that like, this was just me working a random desk job and then going out and trying to stir some shit. And that we could probably all roughly do, there was no particular skill involved in this. It was turning up at shouting about how things were shite and we deserve better. And I think that like, we all have to take that agency into our hands.
Indeed. And yeah, history is non-linear and we're on the steep part of the curve right now. engage and lean in. Absolutely. You just need a big stick for the stirring. Just make sure you bring that along. Wonderful.
Kitchen when you're done.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah, I guess that's everything then. Thanks, listeners, for coming along with us. Thanks, Callum, for coming along with us. It's been absolutely wonderful. We give the last word to the guest. Is there anything you'd like to plug or any stuff coming up? Can people find you on the internet, etc.?
Yes, I'm on Twitter at CallumCamp1. The book is available. I don't care if you buy it on Amazon. I'll let you off. I really don't mind. But yes, please buy the book. And also, I am an editor at a site called Notes From Below. You guys did a Notes From Below, one of your early ones, which was fantastic. And I really encourage you to go go and listen to that. But also we're going to be doing a little relaunch thing and doing some new content on that.
Exciting.
Keep an eye.
Yeah, we need to probably do a bit more of that, yeah, when it comes out.
Right, for sure. And just to give the book a little bit more of a plug, it is a very good read, and it does sort of get to a lot of lived experience of working for Deliveroo that we might not have touched on in this conversation. So, you know, even if you've listened to this podcast, I would recommend picking up the book.
Go buy the book. It's real good. It's short. It's approachable. It's a great read. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, as I said, thanks, listeners. You can catch us on the web at generalintellectunit.net. We're on Twitter at GIUnitPod. If you go to patreon.com/generalintellectunit, you can throw us a couple of bucks a month, get on our community Discord, all that nice stuff. We are also part of the Emancipation Network, so go to emancipation.network on the net. And check out our sister shows, Swampside Chats and From Alpha to Omega. They're wonderful. There's a new show. By the time this airs, there will have been a new show aired. Is that? No, but we better not. We better not spoil that.
Yep. Well, I think for sure it'll definitely have started already.
Okay. Yeah, I can always edit this out if this is the case, but I am. Jumpsuit Utopia is our new show. We're watching Star Trek and talking shit about it. It's pretty awesome.
That sounds like
So I think that's coming out soon. It'll have been out by the time this airs, because it takes months for us to get episodes out. Anyway, whatever. Yeah, I guess that's everything. Thanks, and we'll catch you again in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.